Hello and welcome to Hindsight on ABC Radio National. I'm Michelle Rayner. Today's program is about the history of a single photograph. The picture I'm talking about is an iconic image of a man called One Pound Jimmy. In 1950, his regal profile became a million-selling postage stamp, and his image has become embedded in the national consciousness as the blueprint for what a real Aborigine should look like. Because for decades, this image has been repeated endlessly on tourist posters, government publications, stamps, tea towels, and a myriad of kitsch Aboriginalia. But who was One Pound Jimmy, and what's the story which lies behind that photograph? The tale goes something like this. In the 1930s, a young tourism executive from Melbourne was driving through the desert and encountered this fine specimen of unspoilt primitive native just walking along the road. But the true story is so much more intriguing. Lorena Allam explores the two lives of One Pound Jimmy.
One Pound Jimmy is a famous man for lots of reasons, and his fame is enduring. But One Pound Jimmy, or Goya Djungarai, lived two lives, the life he made for himself and the fantasy life made for him by the rest of the world.
Jimmy's image was actually used to depict explorers, stories of explorers like Leichhardt, Burke and Wills, Kennedy. Now, Kennedy was up in the northeast of Australia, far away from Central Australia. But Jimmy was used to generally be the definitive Aboriginal man across space and time.
What he's become is the ultimate construction, and people, like they do with comic book heroes, they want to ascribe these traits onto this image, and also like deeds. People would like to believe that he's the best shagalig and that he can throw a spear 100 miles and maybe he can fly.
I think it's because he's a very handsome character who, that ideal of the warrior figure, it's a nice portrait by anyone's standards, I believe, but also you had a sense at that time, which was still very prevalent in the 30s when the photograph was taken, that Aboriginal people were totally doomed to extinction.
Tourists would arrive in Alice Springs, hop off the train and ask where they could find One Pound Jimmy. They also reportedly asked other people, other Aboriginal people, to pose like One Pound Jimmy and act like an authentic Aboriginal man. They didn't want an Aboriginal man with clothing. They wanted the walkabout portrait of the mysterious tribal Aboriginal man that was closely associated with the land.
Throughout the history of the image, they've used it to rub out other people, and it sort of rubs us out of history, and it rubs our lives and practices out of the history of the nation. One image of one Aboriginal, it's a really dangerous thing. It'd be like saying that European, if you painted someone in Dutch clogs and a flying nun hat.
In the late 1920s, Australia was beginning to look at ways to display itself as a tourist destination. The National Travel Association, ANTA, was established, with a man called Charles Holmes at its head. Holmes travelled through Central Australia, looking for images for his new tourism magazine, Walkabout. Driving down a dirt road in the desert, Charles Holmes saw a striking young Walpuri and Machira man on his way to a ceremony. Holmes wrote of the encounter in Walkabout.
During a visit to the spotted taiga mica mine out east of Alice Springs, I once met as fine a specimen of Aboriginal manhood as you would wish to see. Tall and lithe, with a particularly well-developed torso, broad forehead, strong features, and the superb carriage of the unspoiled primitive native, he rejoiced under the name One Pound Jimmy.
Charles Holmes instructed his photographer to take a few pictures. For 30 years, Holmes was the head of the National Travel Association, and he used those images of Jimmy over and over again. Historian Jill Barnes has spent several years researching the story of £1 Jimmy. I asked her, of all the people and things Holmes could have photographed, why Jimmy?
Big question. A number of things just came together. At that time, the mid-1930s, there was an enormous amount of change going on in Australia. The Commonwealth had not long taken governance of Central Australia. They were building a railroad, turning their head inward from the coastal strip into Central Australia in an attempt to take possession of the whole continent for a new white nation. And they established ANTA, or the Australian National Travel Association, the same year in 1929 to encourage inland developmental tourism. At the same time, the Commonwealth was also shifting from a policy of segregation, where the assumption was that Aboriginal people would never be accepted into white society, to a policy of absorption and uplift. As part of that, they began to categorise Aboriginal people into different groups. Based on the thinking of the time, this was mixed blood and full blood. And of the latter group, they identified tribal Aboriginal people still living traditional lives as the group to be preserved in Aboriginal reserves, as a wonder of the world and a scenic curiosity to be studied before they died out. So why Jimmy within that context? Firstly, fate played quite a large part. He was clearly in the right place at the right time. ANTA had just been established, and Charles Holmes took a number of tours around Australia and into Australia looking for definitive images of settler Australians as well as Aboriginal Australians. Secondly, Jimmy chose to participate. From the number of photographs that were actually taken during that photographic shoot of Jimmy, other men, women and children, it becomes clear that Jimmy was a willing participant. Thirdly, Jimmy was a photographer's dream. His young athletic body, his striking facial features, his versatility of pose, and his sense of drama made him a very photogenic subject. Plus, because Jimmy was unknown at the time, meant that Holmes could use his image in a lot of different ways. And finally, Jimmy provided precisely the look that Charles Holmes was looking for. Records tell us that there was a very neat fit between the images that Holmes carried around in his head as to what an Aboriginal man looked like and the man that stood before his camera.
Charles Holmes had read a number of accounts of inland Australia by explorers and anthropologists, which influenced his ideas about the places and the people he saw there. Holmes wrote of his travels in 1932 in a book called We Find Australia.
We left these children of the vast solitudes, left them to hunt the weird marsupials as unique as themselves, both relics of a bygone age, left them in their world of magic and make-believe to fight their fight with nature. The Aborigines are a vanishing race of people living thousands of years in the past. Although many of them work on sheep and cattle stations and are more or less civilised, a large number, such as those we saw, still roam the interior undisturbed by the centuries and, except for their decorations on special occasions, are still stark naked and unashamed.
Like many of the leading lights at the time, in tourism circles, Holmes was a Melburnian of British-born parents. From school, he actually went to work for the Victorian Railways as a journalist. He worked for a gentleman by the name of Clapp, who was an Australian, but he actually had worked in the American Railways, in the American West, and brought a lot of American influences to his work with the railways in Australia. And Holmes, in many ways, was Clapp's protege. He worked very closely with him until Clapp died 20 or 30 years later, and he's widely recognised as a very influential man in the development of tourism in Australia.
Does that explain that kind of strong American influence in the imagery that, that Holmes produces? And I'm thinking of the way that those anthropological images of Aboriginal people almost are very similar to the kinds of things that were being made in the American Midwest, photographs of Native Americans at the end of the 1800s, for example.
Yes, very much so. I think that underlying a lot of the images of Native Americans and Aboriginal Australians was a conventional image painted by Joshua Reynolds of Oh My. He was a Tahitian man who was taken back to London, befriended by Joseph Banks, and Joshua Reynolds painted his portrait, which had resounding echoes of Rousseau's Noble Savage. And it's widely seen that that image was highly influential in the way that photographers, anthropologists, other visual image makers actually depicted Indigenous people. There are a number of stock standard poses, gestures, even landscapes, really, that they had Indigenous people pose in.
So that template of how you portray a native person must have been in Holmes's mind when he, as the young, ambitious tourism executive, went scouting Central Australia.
Yes, very much so. I mean, when you read his We Find Australia, there is regular references to Baldwin and Spencer. They were highly at the top of his mind. He uses terminology like Stone Age man. He draws directly from Spencer. There's echoes of Daisy Bates, the passing of the Aborigines. There's also a lot of references to a work by an American medical doctor who came to Australia on an American naval expedition to the Antarctic. Pickering was his name. He was travelling all around the world, compiling a book on comparative anthropology called Races of Man. And Holmes actually drew excerpts from his book to describe Jimmy directly.
So a chance encounter in the desert led to a series of photographs which suited Charles Holmes's ideas of primitive man, perfect images for Walkabout magazine. But like so much about one-pound Jimmy, it's make-believe. According to Jill Barnes, the chance encounter didn't happen at all. Charles Holmes was actually on a tour bus which came to visit the camp of the anthropologist T.G.H. Strello.
It was a Bonds tour lorry who was one of the pioneers of bus travel in Central Australia. He'd taken Holmes previously on similar tours looking for images, and Strello was at his camp, and this busload drove into his camp where he was collecting songs for his works. And a man that he identifies as a railways man, a nice, jolly, decent chap who worked for the Australian National Travel Association, came up to him with others and actually asked him to arrange for a corroboree and for men to pose at the Rock Holes, which was a sacred Indigenous Aboriginal site.
July the 13th, 1935. Towards evening, Bond's lorry came lumbering to the Rock Holes. Then the whole party came to my camp. They wished to take photos of natives posing at the Rock Holes, also a corroboree. One man who came from the Victorian Railways Department was connected with the Australian National Travel Association. He seemed a likeable, decent chap. The rest were nondescript. I could do nothing. I didn't like the manner in which they just burst in upon me, excepting the railway man mentioned before, as though I was the cheap proprietor of a cheap monkey show. I had to take them to Jim Uchiba and tell him what they wanted. Jim took them to the other old fellas, and evidently they agreed to have some sort of a corroboree with whitewash marks tomorrow at the women's camp. The party left.
But shortly after that, a group of very senior lawmen actually went to Strello's camp and said they point-blank refused to pose.
Because it was a sacred site?
Because it was a sacred site, because also in the past I think they had posed for tourism images, and that led to actually a flood of people coming in.
They said, "Our cave is here. Our sacred ceremonial ground is over on the other side of the creek. We're staying here with you. Tomorrow morning we shall stop here." The other whites can dislodge us with their bullets if they like. They promised us tobacco. We don't want it. Don't we get all our tobacco from you? We're not going to show them any sacred ceremonies. Our place is here, and we're not going to interrupt it. We're not going to put any pipe clay on our bodies at the women's camp. Why should we? Others came and added remarks to the following effect. If we decorate ourselves because these white people want to take photos, they will always come back for more. Even now, they're always driving over our Keraminga and coming past our cave. We don't want them to come anymore. We want you to tell that man and woman camped near here to go tomorrow. And those other men who came tonight, if they'd come to us, we'd have told them the same thing that we're telling you now. I was pleased about their loyalty to me, and I hope that tomorrow their rights will be indicated firmly. I have no grudge against Bond's party, but these tourists always demand their favours like lords.
And so what happened was Jimmy apparently stepped into the breach. Given that these men, well, actually given that only a year earlier, an Aboriginal man in the Uluru region had actually, there'd been a tribal killing, and a man had been killed for divulging secret Aboriginal information stories to white collectors of that. A year later, this happened at the Rock Holes, the elderly men refused to pose, and given that the images show Jimmy as a willing participant, I believe that Jimmy stepped into the breach and tried to perhaps avoid a nasty situation and posed.
The photographs of Jimmy taken at the Rock Holes first appeared in Walkabout magazine in 1936. From then on, he played a starring role in Charles Holmes's tourism campaigns. Holmes saw tourism as the fifth pillar in a national education system, alongside museums, churches, schools and libraries, and his role was to educate people in how to best experience the outback. First of all, he used Jimmy to tell the stories of the brave inland explorers.
Jimmy was presented in three ways. He was presented as an Indigenous man standing on top of a desertscape, looking down at the explorers, menacingly, threateningly, looking as if he was going to attack at any moment, the violent foe. He was also presented as the Aboriginal man that stood passively in the landscape, just watching from a height as explorers went by, not offering any resistance. He was also presented with one other man, one more senior man, where the two of them were hiding behind rocks, stalking, shadowing, threatening to attack.
Then Jimmy appeared in stories about the potential wealth of inland Australia. Jill Barnes.
So here we have Holmes trying to teach tourists how to travel through the inland like a prospector looking for minerals or looking for grass for pasture or looking for vast expanses of open space to test atomic weapons or to look for uniquely Australian wilderness areas that could be created into a national park. In the process, Jimmy was presented as Stone Age man, incapable of change within the context of a modern world coming to Central Australia. There's some really striking examples of that. One is an official book which has, at the very start, a double-page spread where a full-page image of Jimmy is on one side of the page and on the other side of the page is a map of the continent which is coloured black and it's blank and totally uninscribed. So the continent was presented generally as a biological backwater and a blank slate upon which the pioneers and prospectors could write this story. Mm-hmm. There's another advertisement produced by TAA, which actually presents Jimmy as a bewildered, disorientated Stone Age man looking up into the sky as a modern jet flies over Uluru. And there's another very striking image of Jimmy and the older man that he was photographed with at the Rock Pools walking away from the camera, naked, into the distance. Adjacent to that image was one of two or more young children looking forward in a classroom, suggesting that they were being uplifted and that they were part of the future.
But nothing could be done for Jimmy.
No.
He was already part of the Stone Age.
It was inevitable extinction.
You're listening to Hindsight on ABC Radio National. I'm Lorena Allam. Today's program is about the two lives of one-pound Jimmy. Jimmy's other life was his real life, lived under his real name, Goya Djungarai. Djungarai was born in his country near central Mount Wedge, 200 kilometres northwest of Alice Springs, in about 1900. As a young man, he lived with the rising tensions along the outback frontier, as more and more pastoralists moved into central Australia.
From the 1890s, pastoralists came increasingly up into that area. And with the introduction of the railway to central Australia, the Commonwealth released new lands. And as a result, there was conflict, particularly during the drought years, a long extended drought years, over water and food sources as cattle increasingly scared away native game. And so there was conflict, and that fed really into the Coniston Massacre of 1928.
Just a few years before Holmes took Jimmy's photograph at Altunga, there'd been a series of mass killings of his people known as the Coniston Massacre. At a place called Yukaru, or Brooks Soak, a dingo trapper called Fred Brooks was killed by an Aboriginal man known as Bullfrog. A local policeman, Constable George Murray, led a series of revenge attacks, shooting men, women and children at least six different sites around Coniston between August and October 1928. There was outrage at the level of violence, and a federal government inquiry was established. It eventually said Constable Murray and the others were acting in self-defence. The official death toll was 31, but witnesses and historians say it was much higher, that upwards of 50 people, possibly several hundred, were shot in a series of acts of mass murder. Alice Springs historian Dick Kimber tells us the story.
Yeah, it was a very severe drought time, and Brooks himself, though, had asked for Bullfrog, whose real name's Kamenalda, I believe, to use his wife to do some washing, and it's quite clear that she did that. But I heard that he had two wives in one account and three in another account, and that the way I heard it was the two senior wives were down there helping with his washing and keeping his camp set up and all that, and then the one morning when the fire went out, Bullfrog woke up with it being quite cold, and his third wife, his youngest wife, had walked down to get water at the soakage, and when he saw the tracks going that way, he became enraged, thinking Brooks had also taken her, and so he went down with a steel tomahawk stuck in the back of his hairstring belt and called out to the two wives who were near Brooks, and Brooks was mending some saddles at that time, and he then pulled the tomahawk out and hit Brooks over the head with him while the two wives held his arms. But that's how I was told the first time I heard that story.
And there were a number of reprisals, weren't there? I mean, the Coniston Massacre was a series of events.
Yes,
after that.
That's true. There were a number led by a mounted Constable Murray, and the evidence he gave was that they called out always for people to surrender, and people had a tendency to react against that, or to flee, or to throw spears or boomerangs or waddies or something like that. But the evidence is questionable, I think. I've looked at that fairly closely and written locally for it, and I think there's some very big question marks about what happened. The man I met called Creeping Charlie, he'd been shot, and in the leg there was still the scar of a bullet through his leg, and He had rolled under some Spinifex tussocks, and Alex Wilson, who was the last surviving member of that patrol, an Aboriginal descent man from Halls Creek area, he had no option but to go on the patrol as a person working in that area. He'd been asked to join, and you had no option but to join in those days. He told me he stood on top of a rock and saw the blood trickling out from under the Spinifex and drew the attention of the patrol to another area, so that was why Creeping Charlie survived. There's also a little cave area where a bullfrog actually survived by hiding in that for a while. I mean, it's the closest equivalent, I suppose, you could say for the Walpiri and a Mudra in particular, Kaitich as well, to have some sense of what a world war was like, I suppose. But there'd also been threats before that, and there'd been shootings before that. I talked with Dini Jabaljari, a really nice character who lived around the Mount Wedge country, and there was a whole group of people were shot down there, totally independent of the Coniston massacre, but at about the same time, because they'd been down and speared a horse on Glen Helen Station.
Dick Kimber doubts that Goya Djungarai, Jimmy, was in the Coniston area at the time of the killings, but Jill Barnes says she's certain Jimmy was a direct survivor.
Newspaper reports record that Jimmy was there. He was actually amongst the people that were dead. He escaped narrowly from bullet fire, and he took refuge in the east of Alice Springs. He left his traditional lands and he stayed there for approximately 5 years. So that's obviously an incredibly different story to a supposed aggressive man that attacked explorers. I mean, Jimmy was a displaced, seemingly innocent, violated man himself by trailblazers up into his ancestral lands. Mm. When he was in the Altunga region for 4 or 5 years while seeking exile and living around the Rock Hole area where Strelo had his camp, he worked for the next 4 or 5 years in the mines for pastoralists, and he also acted as a guide for the pioneering tourism industry at the time. So, I mean, he was very much a supporter of pioneers rather than an inhibitor of development, as the tourism images showed.
Goya Djungarai moved to Napperby, where he worked on the station, mustering, branding and droving cattle. At Napperby, he became a husband and father of five. He adopted three children who'd been orphaned by the Coniston massacre.
Shortly after that, as part of a new government policy in native welfare, all of the family, plus others in the group, being mustered in, like cattle, in trucks, and actually taken to Jay Creek Native Reserve. So Jimmy's life was yet again disrupted, and he, at Jay Creek, adapted his traditional skills and carved artefacts for the tourism industry, and he also acted as a guide for anthropologists, including Charles Mountford, Strelo, I believe, and also he took Bill Harney through his ancestral lands too.
A version of Jimmy's photo appears on the cover of Bill Harney's 1957 book, Life Among the Aborigines. Along with a lot of other images, it's on our website at abc.net.au/rn/hindsight. Jill Barnes believes these travels with anthropologists were Jimmy's chance to visit his country and pass on the knowledge to his children.
Jimmy used the occasion of sitting around the campfire at night after he'd returned home, after showing anthropologists around his country. He'd actually sit around the campfire and talk to his children about where he'd been, about their country, about their stories. And he was very determined, from what I can see, to make sure that Indigenous law, Indigenous traditions were passed on through their sons, when there were very strong assimilative forces trying to sort of disempower Aboriginal people, senior Aboriginal people, and Aboriginal authority.
Two of Djungarai's sons became brilliant artists in their own right. Tim Lura Japaljari and Clifford Possum Japaljari joined the Papanyatula movement in the mid-1970s. Clifford Possum's most famous work, Wallagulong, was bought by the National Gallery a couple of years ago for $2 million. Both of them recalled being told dreaming stories and the law by their father, Djungarai, and those stories appeared in their work. Dick Kimber.
I met his sons and knew them very well. Clifford became the best known, but I thought in the earliest years of that Papunya style, I thought Tim was even a better artist. But there's an interesting painting he did of two skeletons, and the two skeletons, there's one painting by Clifford with them representing the sons associated with the blue tug lizard and the big fire story. There's another one that Tim Lura did, which is two skeletons as though they're walking about with spears and boomerangs in their hands. Most unusual painting, and he said it was his memory of his own father and grandfather walking the country and hunting around the Napperby Creek area.
In 1950, the pretend Jimmy and the real Jimmy finally collided when he became world famous. Australia Post copied Jimmy's portrait from the cover of Walkabout magazine onto the 2-6 stamp. The £1 Jimmy stamp sold 99 million copies over the 16 years it was in circulation. People all over the world wanted to know more about the man on the stamp.
One American stamp collector by the name of McGregor actually contacted Holmes, and he wanted to have his stamp autographed by Jimmy. And this was part of that time when I said earlier, questions were being asked. Who is he? Where is he? How can we find him? And McGregor actually engaged Holmes to find Jimmy, to get this autograph. And there was a search for about 4 years. Jimmy seems to have heard about this somehow, shaved his beard off, went bush, and didn't want to be part of it at all.
Charles Holmes kept readers of Walkabout informed of his efforts to locate £1 Jimmy. It took 4 years.
And a patrol officer eventually found him at Mount Wedge. How he did, I really don't know. The patrol officer took this photograph. It's Jimmy standing in almost precisely the same pose, tilting his head upwards at exactly the same angle, looking into the far distance.
So when the patrol officer found Jimmy, yes, the older Jimmy, the 1950s Jimmy, at Mount Wedge, he asked Jimmy to take his shirt off and pose like the stamp.
Exactly. He wanted, I think, Jimmy to show that he was the real thing. Whereas the image that Holmes ran on the cover of Walkabout magazine when he actually announced that Jimmy had been found had been cropped, and all signs of the clothing, the hat, the pastoral attire had gone.
So the Stone Age man still.
Stone Age man. In fact, Jimmy Holmes actually said now that Jimmy had reached his level of celebrity, he'd escaped from the Stone Age.
The fantasy of Jimmy, the tourism figure, has cast a long shadow over the lives of Aboriginal people ever since. John Mundine is an art historian and an independent curator with a decades-long involvement in Aboriginal art.
Well, given the idea of Australia as a desert, and given the idea that these are the real people, these are the real Aboriginals, it set a stereotype and a line that you were supposed to look like this. And, of course, people, even in those 1890s, didn't all look like this to start with. And then as colonisation happened, of course, people of mixed descent certainly didn't look like this. And so that allowed people to make the divide, because these are the real people, these are the real Aboriginals, these people weren't.
As a Bundjalung man, how does he feel when he looks at these images of Jimmy?
When I look at it, I think of myself. I can't not engage with that person or feel friendly to that person. It's a very familiar Aboriginal person, but it's curious in the way that in complete the reverse of that, you've got white Australians and policymakers and politicians using that to say, well, this was the Aboriginal people that doesn't exist here anymore. They live way out in the desert somewhere. There's a great quote I use of a missionary saying, you have to go a long way to see the Aboriginals. They live way out in the desert. Well, they don't. Aboriginal people live everywhere and do everything. And people lived on the East Coast. They lived on those beaches that we all surf on. Well, Aboriginal people swam in those beaches and enjoyed them and were in love with them just as much as any of contemporary Australian citizens. So Aboriginal people were right across Australia and right across different environments and different geopolitical arrangements, etc. We should be aware of that and realise that Aboriginal people aren't just in the desert.
You described the desert to me earlier as like a Christian Disneyland. What did you mean by a Christian Disneyland?
Yes, I think coming to Australia and you think that Australia's got this image, preconceived image of being a dry continent and a desert, huge desert that is, and in many ways a Christian Disneyland in the sense that if you read the Bible, if you read the Bible and all the stories of Christ going into the desert and fasting and flagellating and whatever and punishing himself to achieve some sort of truth or some final rationalization of life and so on. So people came here and they thought of that. You could live on the coast, but then you went inland and inland was like that. You made this holy sojourn.
The idea of Jimmy had a particular power to render people silent and invisible, and that power is seductive.
There's a quote from a journalist who travelled with Russell Drysdale, and they produced a book in the 50s, I think it's published, or the end, or the beginning of the 60s, and that book. And he says the trouble with the Aboriginals is that they didn't all die out, and it's a problem. That attitude, of course, is totally depressing, or more than depressing, is totally outrageous. But it sort of tells you why they keep bringing this image back to say, well, look, we can't do anything for these Aboriginal people. They're too stupid, they're too uncultured, they're too impossible to work with or do anything with. And so they keep dragging this image back to say these are primitive people. That's why we have these problems with Aboriginal people. And it means you don't have to do anything for the Aboriginal people that live in New South Wales, the Aboriginal people that live in Tasmania or Victoria, etc. And you set up some very paltry program of rations and some other study for the people in the desert, because they're not really human to start with. And these other people, well, they're not really Aboriginal.
The image is also filtered into the way Aboriginal people view themselves and express themselves through art.
It's a really interesting thing, because when you talk about cultural crimes or things like that to do with culture, they have to do with our own personal choices and our own self-image. By promoting this sort of image of this person is the Aboriginal, I said in lots of talks to people in New South Wales and in the southeast of the country that you should never paint a generic Aboriginal. People are then driven or led to think, well, if I paint an Aboriginal, this is what they look like. In fact, say you should never paint that a generic Aboriginal person, as in Jimmy Djungarai. I think that you should paint people that are your relatives. They are the real people, and that's what you should be aiming to live like. And they're your influences, not these propaganda or other subversive images to lead you to self-hate or self-doubt. I don't look like that, therefore there's something wrong with me. Mm. Now, Jimmy had nothing to do with that himself. That's how people, the photographer who was looking for that type, and the nation that wanted to promote this idea. And I think this is a real crime that people should ever think that I'm less a person because I don't look like that. I think that's the real crime of it in the end.
Vernon Arkey is a Brisbane-based artist whose work is held and exhibited here and overseas. He says the construction of Jimmy limits Aboriginal art and the breadth of stories told in art.
Because of what Aboriginal art is and where it kind of sprang from and where it sits now, and the idea that the art from remote communities dominates the idea of Aboriginal art, and Aboriginal art dominates the idea of what Aboriginal people are. I wondered, how come there's no, like, dialysis dreaming? How come there's no, like, diabetes dreaming? Because these are the kind of stories that are actually have something to do with these people's lives and the way they live. And I'm like, how come nobody got, like, a dirt floor dreaming? I've got people in my own family who still live on dirt floor. Clean floor, you know, sweep it, but this still happens, so... But what's the idea of Aborigines that people want to have? What is the idea of ourselves that our own people want to have of us? Mm. And £1 Jimmy still informs that. You can't kid yourself about the position that Aboriginal people have in this society, and that people who aren't Aboriginal don't. But people want to define us by what we're not, so they have this idea, this construction of who £1 Jimmy represents, and it is so heavily laden with things that we are not. And I think if you discount that and look at ourselves and the way we speak and the way we think about our history and the kinds of government legislation that inform our lives now, then surely that says more about who we are and the way we should be speaking about ourselves, the way we should be writing about ourselves and building theoretical frameworks about who we are in our lives, and also the art we make.
Vernon is one of many Aboriginal artists, writers and performers who challenge dominant thinking about identity and race politics. And that dominant thinking has as its mental picture the image of £1 Jimmy.
I believe all my work is firstly produced from a position of strength. I have no interest in sorry industry. I'm open to my own history and my own family, but I don't feel sorry for myself, and I'm not going to engage in any flag waving or bridge walking. But my work is about my family. It's about my own life, and it's about my own experiences, and it's about my family's history. And my family have a history in North Queensland, on Palm Island, in Yarrabah, in Cairns, in Innisfail, where I was born. You know, surely my life is more interesting than some kind of imagined Stone Age existence that Jimmy already inhabits. And so that's what I'm on about. So when I produce my portraits, they're of my family, and I'm trying to give a representation of contemporary Aboriginal life with the level of complexity that we all experience, you know, with the emotional depth that we all experience as just ordinary people in ordinary families. And it's the kind of existence that we have every right to. But then you have these images of the noble savage, and that is anchored in a utopian world that probably never existed. Could not possibly have, actually. And you can say it's dream time, you can say it's story, or you can say it's land. But the fact is, it has nothing to do with contemporary Aboriginal life. And that's the predicament that we are in. And that we have to... you know, rationalise that and well, not necessarily combat it, but we have to make sense of it for ourselves. And what I do, my art makes sense of the world for me. Otherwise, I'd be walking around confused, like so many black fellas do. And this is how I make sense of the world.
Vernon says his work is about trying to humanise Aboriginal people. But this is seen as a political act.
I have skills that underpin my work. I'm a printmaker and I've done some drawing, done design and learning video and photography, but I have drawing skills that underpin everything I do, and I've been drawing seriously for over 30 years. So I'm able to produce portraiture that is beautiful because the drawing, I have the skills to pull it off, and the portraiture is good portraiture, and the drawing is good drawing. So I'm relying on people's ideas around portraiture and the gaze and drawing. People are familiar with drawing, people are familiar with portraiture. And so when these people see these portraits, and they're on a large scale, so they're quite demanding or commanding. And when people see them, they have to acknowledge that it's good portraiture. They have to acknowledge that there's a human approach and a human hand at work here. And they have to acknowledge that the drawing is good drawing. So altogether, it must make a beautiful object and a beautiful surface and a beautiful work of art. And because of that, the subject must then be beautiful also. Mm-hmm. And as much as people want to resist it, they have to admit that, well, there's something here. And particularly given that I'm not producing people who are smiling, and I'm not producing people who are benign. The gaze that I intend for these subjects is meant to be intense. It's this idea that I have of my own people and of myself. And it's the idea that I have of all blackfellas, and I'm using my own family to demonstrate that. There's a sophistry and a complexity to Aboriginal people that is true of all peoples, that I just want to say, well, did you know that we're like this? And did you know that we are beautiful? And did you know that some of us have the skills to pull this kind of work off?
1 pound Jimmy, Goya Jungarai, lived two lives. A real life, punctuated by the trauma of frontier violence, dispossession and upheaval, but also full of family, country and children. The other Jimmy never existed, except in the minds of others. That Jimmy might have escaped the Stone Age, but he's been eclipsed by Aboriginal people taking control of their own representation, demanding you see them for who they are.
And once upon a time, we had no control over our own self-image, in the sense we're written about by anthropologists and we're photographed by outside photographers and filmmakers. And I think now we actually do write our own stories. We paint our own stories, and we take our own photos, and we self-promote our own image. And I think that's one of the major last phases of that. And these people, us, we, you, me, want to tell our story and want to talk about us as individuals as much as our society. We belong to a society, definitely an Aboriginal society, but we also belong individually to ourselves, our own self-image and our own self-worth.
The Two Lives of 1 pound Jimmy was produced by Lorena Allam, and the sound engineer was Phil McKellar. The producers would like to thank Jill Barnes, Dick Kimber, Vernon Arkey and John Mundine. TGH Strello was played by Tony Barrell and Charles Holmes by Tony McGregor. And if you'd like to take a good look at all the images discussed in today's program, then head to our website at abc.net.au/rn/hindsight. And join me next week on Hindsight when we head back into deep time, with two parallel stories of geological discovery. First, we visit 17th century Florence. At a time when science was blossoming, and the world's biblically allotted 6,000 years were almost up, we meet young scholar Nicholas Steno. He began finding seashells on the tops of mountains and postulated that the Earth might just have a much longer history of its own.
Go, my sons, burn your books and buy stout shoes. Climb the mountains, search the valleys, the deserts, the seashores and the deep recesses of the earth. Observe and experiment without ceasing. For in this way, and in no other, will you arrive at the knowledge of the true nature of things.
The Proterozoic Eon.
At 2,500 or 2.5 billion years old, has the first signs of life, microfossils. On one hand, you've got Aristotelian eternalism, and on the other hand, you've got the idea that God actually created the earth. Now, the question then arises, how long ago did he do this creation? That had been an issue that had been treated through, well, since antiquity, really, since the Christian era. And by the 17th century, which is Steno's time, people were beginning to try to put numbers on the age of the earth. By looking at the Bible, this was involved a historical analysis of what dates there are in the Bible, which was a pretty difficult job. The begat theory, X begat Y, who begat Z, and so on. And you can add these all together and get some dates. But then you've got to try to mesh that with Egyptian history as well, and Greek history. Eventually, a date came up, was produced by Bishop Usher, 4004 BC as being the date of the creation of Earth. That gives you an idea of the kind of timescale that was envisaged by most people by the 17th century. And eternalism was not wanted, because if you had eternalism, the cosmos couldn't really have been created by God if it was there always.
When we contrast the 6,000 and something years of biblical chronology with the millions and billions of years of modern geology, the gap is tremendous. But Steno operated with a chronology that was considerably longer. Actually, in his geological work, he refers to biblical narratives, but there is no fixed chronology. He just pulls in the Bible to say, yes, the Bible actually also speaks about moist and dry periods alternating.
But this was also, of course, a dangerous topic.
You see, I cast the die and I write the book. Whether it be read by the people of the present or of the future makes no difference. Let it await its reader for 100 years. If God himself has stood ready for 6,000 years for one to study him.
And we also meet the young Mary Anning, an early 19th century fossil hunter from England's Dorset coast, whose discoveries contributed to the next big revolution in geological thought. Lost in Time and the Fossil Collectors, next week on Hindsight. I'm Michelle Rayner, and I look forward to your company then, here on ABC Radio National.
On the Law Report, the case of Andrew Murray Pollock, the Queensland man who killed his dad back in 2004. The High Court has just quashed his murder conviction and sent him back for what will be a third trial. this long-running legal saga is all about the controversial defence of provocation. That's where a killer argues they lost control as a result of something done by the deceased. That's on The Law Report with me, Damien Carrick. The program is also available online as a podcast or as streaming audio.